I'm Kara Roselle, and this is Made by Many, where I talk with friends and peers about their inspirations, motivations, and more. As always, hoping this finds you where you are.
Hello, everybody. Today on Made by Many, we have a student, a climate justice activist, and the founder of Zero Hour, an intersectional movement of youth activists fighting for a livable planet for all, and so much more. Jamie Margolin, thank you so much for being on and taking time today to talk to me about things you're passionate about and really things that are affecting us all.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so thrilled to talk to you. Like we talked a little bit before we went live on this, but I'm just really curious about what sparked your involvement and your passion for climate justice.
I mean, what sparked my passion for climate activism is honestly initially existential dread. It's very difficult to plan for my life, for my future. Something that I'm constantly being asked to do is plan for your life, plan for your future, da da da. And it's really hard to do that when you feel this looming threat of there is no future. You know, I walk through Union Square Park sometimes in New York City, and there's a big climate countdown clock that is now like, we're down to 6 years we have left in order to solve everything. And it's like these big letters, it's like 6 years. And you see from the seconds to the hours, to the days, to the months, it's terrifying.
Yep.
And I'm just like, that's less than a decade. And so it can be easy to feel very nihilistic and just be like, well, might as well just like party while the world burns. But there's also always been a part of me that has this, I'm not an optimist, but I'm not a pessimist. But I'm not a realist either. I guess I'd say I'm someone who just has this stubborn belief that somehow everything has to turn out okay in the end. Maybe that's comes from the filmmaker part of me that, you know, wants to write happily ever afters for a living. But I always, for me, what got me into climate action was initially I was full of apathy, not apathy, but I was so horrified that I was like, there's nothing I can do. We might as well just lay down and die already because, you know, what's the point? But there's that little part of me that, that's very resilient, and that there's this tiny little voice that's like, but somehow we have to do this. Like, it refuses to believe. Like, you can show me all these numbers, it's like, we're never going to make it out of this alive. Mm-hmm. And I respect facts, obviously, but I hang on to the hope and like refuse to believe that the battle's over. Like, there has to be a happily ever after. And I know that's cheesy, but for me, I just, this can't end now. You know what I'm saying? In terms of life on Earth.
Right. No, I mean, I think that I like that too, the little bit of like optimism or hope that you're hanging on to, like the fact, thinking that for the human race, for all life on Earth, like this can't be it.
And that's what I've been hanging on to when I get bad news about climate crisis and bad news about stuff like that. I'm just like, this can't be it. This can't be it.
That kind of goes into something that I think I've been seeing a lot. I think it's always been around, but I think just in more recent weeks, for some reason, maybe my feed is just showing it to me, but a lot of talk about climate anxiety. Can you talk a bit about that and about how, I guess, that goes hand in hand with how you opened with existential dread, but just the anxiety around the climate crisis, anxiety around people not taking it seriously, all that goes with that.
Yeah, so climate anxiety is honestly something that almost prevented me from even beginning the organization that I'm known for founding, Zero Hour, because I had such a bout of such horrible climate anxiety in 2017 when I learned about Hurricane Maria, Hurricane Harvey, all of these like wildfires that were happening. I was reading this, like, I think it was in the New York Magazine, this article that's like, no matter what we do, we're all doomed. There's no hope. Anyone saying that there's hope is lying to you. And I went down a rabbit hole of reading these like scientific, we're not going to make it. These are the numbers. These are where we are. Like, we're just not going to make it. I was seeing the deterioration around me of Seattle, of like the wildlife, the ocean acidification, the wildfire. We used to never have a wildfire season in the Pacific Northwest. It was just like, but now we have smog that covers our city from the fires that happen around us. Not necessarily like in Seattle, they're not in Seattle, but like around in the area that cause wildfires to have smoke so severe that it blows over the city. So all of that anxiety, I was just paralyzed. Action was the way I pulled myself out of it. I was like, well, I have to at least try to do something. And that's when I co-founded Zero Hour. But for a while, like, I was just in a state of like, what is the point of anything? Mm-hmm. Because the thing with climate anxiety is it's not just anxiety about a particular issue. It's anxiety about life on Earth as we know it. And so if life on Earth as we know it is doomed, then it's very easy to start to get extremely nihilistic and be like, well, then what is the point of doing anything ever? Why am I going to school? Why am I going to work? And that's what the strike movement comes from, as well as like, why go to school to study for something that doesn't exist. But I think there has to be some balance, because if we all just like lay down and we're like, what's the point in just all fell into a nihilistic puddle, then there would actually be no hope.
No, that's totally true. Can you talk more about the strike movement?
Yeah. So Zero Hour organized the youth climate marches in 2018, and we had the marches the July of 2018 in 25 cities around the world. I was informed that a girl in Sweden named Greta Thunberg was going to plan a Zero Hour sister action. So basically what we did was we had the youth climate marches in Washington, D.C. was like the main one, but then people, individual organizers, organized their own actions on their own accord in solidarity with our D.C. action all around the world. And Greta was going to do a Zero Hour. This was before she started striking, before she was, you know, known as Greta Thunberg, yeah, as she is today. She was going to organize a Zero Hour sister action, but then decided on her striking idea as well. And so a little bit after we had our big march, she decided to start school striking. I think I saw that she was following me on social media, and I followed her back and I messaged her like, whoa, this strike thing that you're doing, this is kind of cool. Like, I hope this takes off, kind of amplifying. And then long story short, it did take off, and the world, a movement was born through the school strike movement, where students all around the world started to do what Greta did and to strike a bit and strike and protest in different ways and around their communities. So that's really how it got started. Zero Hour and the work that we did was like the precursor, the domino effect. So if you look at like the domino effect that pushed the foundation of Fridays for Future and the school strike movement.
You of course had mentioned your organization, which is Zero Hour. Can you talk about, like, I know intersectionality is a focus, and I know that a lot of people, especially people that I don't identify as people of color, don't always understand the intersectionality of climate change, the climate crisis, and everything else and other disparities in the world.
So Zero Hour is the way that it was started. So basically it was around that time in 2017, I was 15 years old, and I was struggling through a really, really bad bout of climate anxiety, where I was just absolutely hopeless. And, you know, that was also a time where the former president pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accords. And it was just like bad news after bad news after bad news. And then that little voice in me that's always like, you have to make this okay. Like, it can't end like this. Like, it has to turn out okay. Like, there has to be some happy ending, you know. Studying like storytelling strategies, like as an aspiring screenwriter, there's always in the storytelling structure, there's always the part where it seems like all the odds are stacked against the protagonists, and then against all odds, they beat the bad guys. And so I kind of framed it like that, like, okay, yeah, the odds are stacked against us, but every movie ever made, that's like usually a part of the structure where there's a point in the story where sometimes it feels like they're not going to win. And so that kind of, I pushed myself out of that.
Like, apply that to real life, basically.
I tried to apply that to real life, and I pushed myself out of that. I was 15 years old, and I posted on social media that I was going to start a youth climate march. I asked who's with me, and then I just started to recruit different people from my front to join the organization all around the country, and then it just expanded and expanded. And we were called Zero Hour because this is Zero Hour to act on climate change. There's no more time. And what we organized was youth climate marches in Washington, D.C. and 25 cities around the world, a youth climate lobby day where we lobbied our 47 members of the Senate. Youth met with 47 members of the Senate to ask them to sign a no fossil fuel money pledge to get fossil fuel money out of politics. And then we had a youth climate art festival where we had, that was like the day before the march, where we had people creating art and banners and stuff like that for the march. And it was like it was a nice community event. And then ever since then, we've just kept organizing and mobilizing. We played a big role in the September 2019 strikes, in the March strikes, just a lot of the climate strikes. And also we organized the Youth Climate Action Summit in Miami, Florida in the summer of 2019. Because that's an area highly affected by the climate crisis, and we wanted to throw an event for organizers and people who want to get involved in climate action. And so we organized that summit. And then we've just been doing a bunch of campaigns ever since then. You can't really be a true environmentalist if you don't actually understand the intersections that it has with social justice, racial justice, et cetera. The thing is, the climate crisis is directly a result of colonialism. It's the colonial extraction when colonizers came to the Americas and other parts of the world to extract gold, to extract other resources, to treat humans like resources to be extracted from, and dehumanizing indigenous people, Black people, using humans for labor, just as stuff to be extracted from, using the earth as something to be extracted from, with the only goal in mind being profit. And that was, like, you know, early capitalism. And so climate change stems from issues of racism, issues of indigenous rights, issues of land rights, issues of, like I said, indigenous sovereignty, issues of the people who are impacted the worst by the climate crisis are people of color, or people who are not financially privileged, or just basically if you are at any way marginalized by society, that therefore you have less access to resources, less power. You are going to be the most affected by the climate crisis because you won't have as many resources, privilege, power to be able to be able to get yourself out of bad situations in terms of wildfires, natural disasters, etc. I forget the exact statistics, but roughly 69% of coal plants are built around Black communities. That's not a coincidence. That's because the fossil fuel industry knows that because of the long, 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 long history of systemic racism, they can get away with poisoning a Black community in a way that they couldn't get away with poisoning a white community because of the way that white supremacy deems people of some skin colors as lives that are to be valued and people with other skin colors as lives that are not to be valued. So the people with the skin colors or cultures that the systems of oppression deem as, like, not valuable, not as good, that's where they can get away with those are the people that they can get away with extracting from, based on that long history of colonization and racism. And yeah, that also happens with indigenous communities. If you think of all the pipelines that are built on indigenous communities, the Dakota Access Pipeline was initially not going to be built on indigenous land. They were going to, but it was rerouted to be built directly on indigenous land because the other community objected to it. But even when the indigenous community objected to it, then they didn't listen and they didn't
care. I remember watching your TED Talk, and were you quoting Jesse Jackson? And when he was saying that it was an example of, like, one of the worst example of environmental racism that he's seen in recent times.
And it also goes for gender issues too. According to the United Nations, 80% of the people displaced by climate change are women. And the reason is simple. In a lot of countries and places, you know, women are in charge of food or water, gathering food, getting water, and that is growing scarcer in terms of, in some places, because of the climate crisis. But mostly it's because of the lower socioeconomic status that women generally have because of the wage gap, because of different. And it varies differently for different countries and cultures, but when women are not economically advantaged, not seen as having power, and not given all of these rights that we deserve in society, it makes it a lot harder for a woman to be able to make her way out of climate disaster than it would be for a man who might have more economic rights and benefits. And this isn't just my opinion. This is not me just, oh, she's a feminist claiming that women are oppressed at every level. No, it's the United Nations. 80% of the people displaced by climate change are women. So this is also an inherently feminist issue and an issue of patriarchy, because the societies that colonized, which is why we're here in the first, which is why we're in this issue, like, thanks a lot, guys. The societies that were the colonizers were very patriarchal societies too. And if you think about it, the way we extract from and hurt women is the same way we extract from and hurt the earth. Like, I feel like power treats the earth the same way that it treats women.
100%.
Think of the most influential climate, like, voices that you know. Aren't a lot of them women?
They are. That kind of goes to how many people that raise their voices when injustices are happening, like in the scheme of racism, in the scheme of the colonization in our country, it's a lot of people of color. And I just recently watched the Marsha P. Johnson documentary, which was very late, but better late than never. And knowing that she raised her voice as part of a transgender person in the LGBTQ community and as a Black person. And realizing that, like, women are raising their voices because we are the most affected by it.
Definitely. The people that are, like, when it comes to LGBT liberation, you know, I love visiting Stonewall a lot. I go there all the time and I just stand there and I'm like, this is where the revolution happened. Especially as a gay woman, I sit there and I'm like, I have the rights that I have thanks to the people who rioted right here where I'm standing. And the people who started the what we now know as Pride were a black and Latinx trans women, some of the most marginalized people.
Sylvia Rivera too.
Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, black and Latino trans women. The people who are the most marginalized are often the ones who, like, blow the whistle first, raise their voices first, because it's, I feel like when you're in a level of privilege, if you have a certain level of privilege, it becomes a choice that you decide whether to raise your voice or not. But when you're, obviously everything's a choice, but you're not, but when you're so marginalized that raising your voice is like, it's survival in a sense, you know, people with privilege can sit back and choose whether to get involved with the cause. But if you and your life and your identity is like actively being hurt, then unfortunately you don't get to make the decision of, do I want to be involved in this fight for liberation? Like, your survival is entrenched in that fight for liberation. And so the way that compares to, in terms of the environmental movement, are indigenous people. Like, the vast majority of forest lands and all of the green spaces in the world, the people who are protecting them are indigenous people. Without indigenous people, they are the people on the front lines. They are the protectors, and the ones who have been on the front lines since before the environmental movement was even started, since before there was a climate movement. And the climate crisis affects indigenous communities the worst in a lot of cases, both like in North America with, for example, the building of pipelines and Dakota Access Pipeline and other pipelines, but also in the Amazon rainforest with the deforestation. And also, so my family's from Colombia, and Colombia has the highest rates of murders of environmental activists, because a lot of the people who try to stop the illegal logging in the Amazon rainforest get shot and killed by those illegal loggers. And so, like, the people on the front lines, like, especially indigenous people on the front lines who are putting their bodies on the line to defend the land, the forest, I consider the Amazon rainforest the lungs of our planet. They're defending the lungs of our planet, and they get killed for it. And so we not only have to protect the earth, but we have to protect the protectors. Or there's this campaign called Defend the Defenders, in terms of those on the front lines worst affected also are put in danger for the work that they do. Like, many environmental frontline, especially indigenous Latin American activists, are being murdered at like a really high rate. If you want to get involved specifically in protecting, like, those defending the Amazon rainforest, I would recommend you follow Amazon Watch. They do a lot of great work with different indigenous Amazonian communities across the different borders of the Latin American countries.
I'm going to follow them right now so that I don't forget. And do you think, as well with getting involved, that there's a link between age as well with youth getting so involved with movements like climate change and climate activism, being that the people that do have the privilege, I guess, in that sense, are people that are older and may not see that their life is running out on the planet, essentially, and they don't have to face that as much as the youth have to face that. Do you think that there's a link there too?
Here's the thing. Before, I was really big on the whole, like, youth thing, like, youth are the one who are most effective, like, listen to the youth. Youth are the one who are the worst impacted by the climate crisis. And there is an extent of, we are inheriting a future that we did nothing to create. Like, we didn't vote in the politicians who created this mess. We didn't work in the companies that created this mess, but yet we are inheriting it. And so there is some level of moral high ground of young people, which is why, like, young people are stepping up and why there is such a fascination with the youth movement. But I also think, lately, especially because, you know, I started when I was 14, and I've been in this 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and now I'm 19. And at some point, like, I'm not going to be a teenager for much longer. And I feel like you either age or you die. Like, at some point, you're not going to be a young person forever. And I've been trying to pivot away from the way I define my activism as just solely like youth, like focus on the youth. We're getting too pigeonholed by age. You know, I went along with the whole youth thing, and I mean, my book's called Youth to Power. I wrote a book about how young people can be organizers. And so it's not that I, by any means, am overlooking the power of young people. I just am now pivoting towards the power of intergenerational action. I mean, there are elders in the Amazon rainforest who have been fighting to protect the Amazon rainforest who've been fighting for the earth when I was in diapers. So it's disrespectful to be like, oh, like the youth are the ones who know what's up and everyone in the old generation shouldn't, like they should be ashamed of themselves, because it's like, what about all the older activists who are the reason why I can be an activist today? What about the elders in the Amazon? What about like the elders at Standing Rock? Like, are we mad at them? No. Like, it's, what about the people of all ages doing this work? The people in their 30s, people in their 40s, people in their 50s, people in their late 20s. Like, every generation has something to offer. I think what I don't like is the angelization, or this kind of lifting Generation Z on some sort of pedestal when we're just as great and just as bad as any other generation. There just happens to be more attention on the work that we're doing. And now with the advent of social media, it's easier to track the work that's being done because there's a digital footprint of who says what. But I don't consider like young generations to be any better or worse than everyone in any other generation.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit too about how social media has been used as a tool for you and for other organizers and for other activists, like how it's been a helpful tool, how it's been, maybe if it has its cons, but just how social media has shaped the work, helped and shaped the work that you're doing?
Social media has helped shape the work that I'm doing because, I mean, without it, Zero Hour couldn't have been started. I started it with a post on social media. And to be clear, it's not like, oh, and then the post went viral and everything was history from there. No, like 12 people saw that post. But I posted it and one person named Nadia Nazar from Baltimore reached out and DM'd me and said, hey, I really want to get involved. And then the two of us reached out to other people, and that's how we started to build. And then the way that we advertised and got like and met a lot of influencers and celebrities and people who wanted to support our work was through social media. And so social media is not what created. I don't think social media is like you can entirely rely on it, because in the end you have to remind yourself that it's not real life, but it has created a huge, huge, it's a huge tool for activists because word can spread a lot quicker. Instead of like running around and handing flyers to people, you can post a graphic with all of the information needed and be like, show up at this park at this time, wear this, as opposed to like knocking on doors and handing out flyers and hoping people will get the message, or email lists that people often don't check.
Do you still do that type of legwork as well, or do you rely more heavily now on social media?
I mean, with the pandemic, no one's going up to strangers handing flyers out for anything.
Did.
So we did that legwork. Well, some people do, but most people are not eager to, you know, interact with people like that. But basically, for our youth climate march and our youth climate, for the youth climate summit in Miami, it was very hands-on. You can't just post something and expect people to show up, because people are inundated with so many post graphics. Show up here this time. We put up stickers all over Miami. We put up signs all over Miami. We handed out flyers over Miami. It was so hot and sweaty, and we were out flyering, and we were out printing out flyers, talking to people, recruiting people, getting them to physically sign things. Like, that is never going to go away. That is always the most effective form of communication. I scroll through a million graphics of show up here, event here, da 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 da, and I'm like, okay, cool, good for them. But I'm much more likely to show up if you talk to me and you're like, okay, look, this is who's going to be there. It's going to be great. Personal connection. For the Youth Climate March back in DC, like some folks like did some wheat pasting, did some art, did some wheat pasting around the city, did some flyers around the city, knocked on different doors. We're like kind of canvassing for our march and really getting people to attend that way. So that's really how you turn out a crowd to whatever you're working on. Is you can't just post a graphic and expect everyone to be there, unless you're like, I don't know, if Beyonce posted a graphic and was like, come here at this time. Like, if you're a certain level of celebrity,
right,
you don't have to do that outreach. But if you're like not Rihanna or Beyonce or whatever, then you have to do a little legwork.
And then you talked about your book as well. And I was wondering if there's anything that we can talk about or you are comfortable communicating in this podcast and how youth, but now just everybody and anybody in general can get involved in organizing and get involved in trying to activate that part of themselves that wants to see better for themselves and wants to see better for their community and in turn the world.
Yeah, I mean, Youth to Power, what it is basically the book that I always wished that I would have had when I was younger. I was always thinking like, oh, how do I get involved? How do I do this? I really want to make a difference, but I don't know how, what do I do? And that eventually turned into Youth to Power, because after the youth climate marches took off, and then subsequently right after that, the school strike movement launched on the back of the work that we had done, suddenly I was going to all of these different events and conferences and speaking about climate action to these conferences and showing the work that I had done. And I would get people who would walk up to me after my speeches all the time and be like, how can I get involved? I want to know how to be an activist. I scroll through my like Instagram, like DM requests. It's like, hey, do you have any tips? Do you have any tips? And I'm like, so everyone wants to know the same thing. And there doesn't seem to be a clear consolidated place of information for people to find this. And so I wrote the book that is essentially the ultimate guide to being an activist for any cause. And while it is called Youth to Power, and there are some chapters in the book that talk about, for example, like dealing with unsupportive parents, like being a minor during elections and stuff, and like schoolwork and balancing like high school and very like youth specific things, the rest of it are just tools for general strategies, types of actions, how to organize, that can be used whether you're 9 or 90.
Yeah, I feel like that's how honestly some of the best things are born, when somebody realizes that there's a void and that's something that they're looking for themselves, and then creating that kind of out of vulnerability in your own lived experience and helping so many other people. So I'm glad that you saw through so many
requests. That's the only things I create. I only create what I wish I would have seen. So, I mean, for example, I'm in film school right now at NYU. I'm here to create the LGBT representation for girls like me that I always wished that I would have seen but didn't. So I'm going to make the content that little Jamie could have really benefited from. Mm-hmm. And in terms of my writing for Youth to Power, I'm going to write the book that little Jamie really needed at that time. And so even though I couldn't have that content and that information that really would have helped me in the moment when I needed it, I can now create it for others who can now have that in the moment that they need it.
That's how I feel about a lot of my content, both online through writing and just like on TikTok now. I feel like TikTok is just a very big creative outlet, but just creating content and visibility and taking up space in a way that I didn't feel comfortable when I was younger, and feeling like now I'm in that place that I can do it. And it's not so much about talking about negative experiences or woe is me, but to kind of highlight and show anybody else that's still struggling with that, or any other people that are younger that still are living that and going through those issues, that it gets better and you're also valid and can take up this space.
Yes, 100%.
Towards the end of a lot of the episodes that I do, I like to ask one question, and it is, who and or what keeps you going?
What keeps me going, honestly, are movies and shows mean the world to me, because in this world, just so many awful things have happened to me, have happened to people around me. I see happening in the news all the time. If I'm just constantly, look, the real world sucks. I hate the real world. So if I'm just constantly in the real world, like I can't be in the real world constantly with no breaks. My happy place is in the movie theater. My happy place is that's definitely like, where are you most happiest? In the movie theater, watching something I love, or creating on set, creating a movie or a show that I know people are gonna, you know, hopefully sit in the movie theater and watch and love. And so what keeps me going is the art that I consume, because it's not only is it escapism, but it's a kind of a reminder of different aspects of life that you forget. It makes you question different films, make you question different things, put things in perspective, put your own problems in perspective, lift your spirits, or make you realize the world is bigger than just what's going on in your mind. I mean, that's why everyone expected me when, you know, I'm a climate activist, author about activism, they expected me to major in political science, but instead I went to art school because art is my refuge and that's what keeps me going. And I want to spend my life making it, because that's kind of the only times that I'm really happy and not like stressed out about the world around me, is when I'm consuming or making art that I feel like is really valuable.
Thank you so much for being on today. I really appreciated it. I really loved speaking with you, hearing more about your book, your activism, and your work. It's so needed and it's so necessary.
Thank you for having me.